This is Jason Breno for Global Public Media, interviewing Jeff Goodell, author of Big Coal, on May 18th, 2006. In the future, energy will most likely be more expensive and scarce, giving mining companies incentive to cut corners to save on costs. What corners can be cut to save money, and how can this be prevented?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think the industry is so good at cutting corners already, it's hard to know what more corners they're going to cut. With these deaths early this year with the Sego and Alma mines in West Virginia, where 14 miners were killed in a space of 3 weeks. There's a criminal investigations in one of those mines now. You saw 200 mining violations at the Sego mine itself the year before the mining deaths there. I think that it's impossible to underestimate what corners will be cut. And one thing you can be sure of with this is that worker safety will not be of the primary concern when these corners are cut. What will be of the primary concern, as is always a primary concern with the coal industry, is production. So, I think it's impossible to really speculate beyond that.
In your book, you are a heavy proponent of IGCC technology. Please explain what IGCC is, does, and what it can do for the electrical power industry and perhaps industrial customers facing high natural gas prices.
IGCC is an abbreviation for Integrated Gasification Combined Cycle. It is a kind of, instead of combusting the coal in the conventional way where the coal is ground up into dust and blown into a boiler where it's burned, same technology essentially they've been doing for 100 years, they use essentially a chemical process to heat the coal and under pressure to drive the gas off the coal, creating essentially a synthetic natural gas. And there's a lot of advantages to this. Among them are increased efficiency, less water usage, things like that. But also, this coal gasification process can be used, and in fact is used right now around the world for creating fertilizers, things like that. You can, once you gasify the coal, you don't have to then burn the gas in a conventional, essentially a conventional gas turbine to create electricity. You can also use that gas to make fertilizers, to do a variety of chemical processes with the natural gas. So it opens the door to things that are called polygeneration plants, where you might be able to, when the electricity price is right, generate electricity from this gasification plant. And then if electricity prices fall to a certain level where it's no more profitable, you could then, say, make fertilizers. And if that changed, you could make chemicals. You could essentially use it for a variety of things, which is a lot of flexibility and very appealing. The other important thing about them is that they're really the only way that, because carbon dioxide can be captured prior to combustion on these plants, it's a much more efficient and economical way of capturing the carbon dioxide and eventually sequestering it underground. So it allows you to use coal while still doing something about global warming.
How would this be implemented in a grand scale across the world? How much would it cost? And how much more energy would it use in order to implement this, to actually pump the carbon dioxide into the ground or perhaps into an oil field for enhanced recovery?
Well, enhanced oil recovery is the most economical use of this carbon dioxide, and that was what you'll see with the first plants that are going up will be enhanced oil recovery. They already use carbon dioxide to enhance oil recovery in many oil fields, but they actually, don't get it from gasification plants, they get it from other sources. From an oil recovery point of view and from an economic point of view, it makes a lot of sense to do this. The price right now, the industry will tell you, is 10 to 20% higher for a gasification plant compared to a conventional coal plant. But that's only by today's, and that even those economics are a little suspect. Most people will tell you off the record that it's closer to break even. And once you start to factor in a price for carbon dioxide, then the IGCC plants get much more economical. And I think as soon as you see any price on carbon dioxide, you will see everyone shifting to IGCC plants. The problem with IGCC plants is that the idea of being able to capture the carbon dioxide and things only works in certain areas of the world where the geology underneath them would be sufficient to or appropriate to hold the sequestered carbon dioxide. So they're not a magic bullet solution in any sense, but they are a step in the right direction, and they are more efficient than a conventional plant by about 10%, which helps.
Coal is being proposed to create synthetic diesel fuel in large quantities. with petroleum production, conventional petroleum, expected to decline by rates of 2 to 5% in the coming years, this technology may be needed. In your book, you advocate against this. Could you describe your reasons why this is a bad decision?
In my book, I don't really advocate against it, you know, in the sense that I think these coal plants are going to, I mean, these coal to liquid plants, the technology is doable. It's used widely used in, you know, South Africa. It was invented, in fact, under Hitler during World War II. It's a doable technology. Wall Street loves it because it's a big capital project, and they know how to fund it, and they have evidence, you know, that it works in South Africa. And so there's a lot of sort of money behind it. And in addition, you have governors like the governor of Montana, who's pushing this very hard because it's a way of using Montana coal reserves. I think it's doable. I have three problems with it. One is that it plays into the idea that if we run out of gas and oil, no big deal, we can just switch over to coal. In fact, these plants can be built, but to be built on a scale that will really make much of a dent in production of oil and gas is going to be enormously expensive. One of the plants that Governor of Montana is advocating is a 150,000 barrel a day plant, which is modest size refinery. And the price tag for that would be about $7 billion. And, you know, at this price, it's just an enormously expensive undertaking. So that's one issue, that is that this can be done, but it's never going to be scaled up quickly enough to really make a huge impact on our oil production. It's not going to make up for what we're going to be losing from petroleum. Second thing is that no one talks about the other problems with this technology, which one of the big ones is water usage. You essentially need to use 3 barrels of water for 1 barrel of liquid fuel production, and that in places like Montana is a nightmare. Third of all, the prices of these plants don't consider carbon dioxide sequestration, which can be done, but aren't factored into the price yet. And as they stand now, they are a step backwards as far as greenhouse gases go from conventional refineries. So my basic bottom line is that I think they're going to be built, and I think that for certain applications, for example, the military is very interested in this as a backup fuel, a way of ensuring that they have enough fuel for their military operations, no matter what happens in the Middle East or anywhere else for that matter. And if you look at it through that lens, you know, it makes a lot of sense. The problem is that the coal industry, as in many other things it does, tries to sell this as the answer, and it's not.
Do you have any estimate as to how this would affect the peak production of coal if we decided to go for a coal-to-liquids mitigation solution for the coming oil crisis?
Well, like I said, I think coal is only going to make a small dent in the coming oil crisis. These plants are incredibly complicated and expensive and difficult to build, and we're going to see a few of them going up, but you know, they're going to be mine mouth, what are called mine mouth plants. They're going to be built at or on top of coal reserves so that the coal can be mined and essentially shoveled right into the plant, and there's no railroads or barges or anything like that involved. So coal will come out of the ground, will go into the plant, and liquid fuels, diesel essentially, will come out the other end. And, you know, I think you're going to see a number of these in Montana where the governor is pushing hard. I think you're going to see a number of these in Illinois. But still, this is just a tiny drop in the bucket compared to what America is really going to need when the oil and gas crisis gets serious.
And what would be the consequences of building these plants? And perhaps a bunch of these plants also are being built worldwide. What are the consequences of attempting to get these plants through and get them built before any major treaties for global warming get signed and put into law?
Well, the consequences, if they don't use most of them aren't. If they don't have carbon sequestration, in other words, they don't capture the carbon and sequester it underground, it's a nightmare. You can just wave goodbye to any hope of a stable climate if these plants get built at anywhere near the rate that they're being predicted right now. So that's the big one. And the other one, I think, is it's almost psychological. I mean, peak oil is real. You know, we're running out of gas. The idea that, you know, we can just substitute coal is a deadly illusion. We need to think really and seriously about what we're going to do in this post-carbon world. And the problem with this whole coal fantasy is that it just delays that reality. It's another, you know, delusion of consumerist appetite that we're just trying to substitute the word coal for the word gas. And it's, and I think that's the most deadly thing, is that it prevents us from facing the harsh reality that's rushing in to meet us.
Many climate scientists have advocated a reduction of greenhouse gases, 60 to 80% of today's emissions. If this option is implemented, how would the coal industry be changed?
Well, I mean, if you're asking if anyone ever got real about reducing CO2 to those levels, to 68 to 80% by mid-century, which a lot of climate scientists are saying is what we need to do to avoid dangerous climate change. If you're saying if that really happened, the coal industry would have to shut down. There would be no coal industry. I mean, there's no way they could adapt to that. And that's essentially why I don't think it's going to happen. That's why I'm so concerned about global warming, because, you know, we're seeing incremental progress towards this. We're seeing the idea of reducing carbon dioxide emissions by 60 to 80% by 2050 is just, you know, it would essentially mean the end of coal. There's just no way you could, the industry could adapt. You would have a few IGCC plants perhaps here and there, but that would be the end of coal. And what the economic implications of that would be, who knows? I mean, it would be devastating given the fact that 50% of our electricity comes from coal now. So for that reason alone, I don't think that's going to happen. I think that, you know, we're going to go marching into this global warming thing with in a very dangerous way. I just don't think that anything near those kind of reductions are going to happen. And that's a frightening thought.
Is there anything else you would like to add?
I just think that in the big picture, we're going to look back on this time, and it'll be sort of like the time when clipper ships gave way to airline travel. And I think that we're on a similar kind of transition here, where you're seeing these old ships like coal desperately trying to put up more sails and figure out ways to get more oars in the water, while you have these people who are beginning to build airplanes and figure out new ways of doing things. And I think that's where coal is right now.
One last question. Where do you think we have to go in the next, let's say, 10 to 20 years in order to finally solve the problems of global warming, peak oil, and have a sustainable society? What does this country and the rest of the world need to do?
Well, boy, if I had the answer to that, I would... That is the right question to ask, and the question that I don't know how to answer. I mean, it was interesting when I started reporting this book. It was in 2000, essentially 2001, 2002, and I would be looking into global warming and talking to climate scientists. And I went out for a month on a research vessel in the North Atlantic and studied the ocean circulation patterns and things like that. And we were out on this ship in the North Atlantic, and I asked this quite renowned climate scientist from Woods Hole, a guy named Lloyd Kegwin, what he thought it would take to wake America up to, you know, what's really at stake here. We were talking about global warming. And, you know, he said to me, well, you know, maybe when a hurricane comes in and wipes out New Orleans, that's when we'll wake up. Well, you know, the hurricane came, and it wiped out New Orleans, and climate scientists argue about exactly how much of it was related to climate change and all that, but I think it's pretty clear that warming waters in the ocean helped to amp up Hurricane Katrina. But anyway, it came, and, you know, essentially nothing has changed. So I don't know. I mean, I'm with people like Jim Kunstler, who think that we're really marching in off a cliff, and I don't know what will wake us up. But I do know this. I don't think that coal is going to save us.
Well, I thank you for your time, and maybe we should let our listeners know how they could get a copy of your book.
Well, the easiest way, it's published by Houghton Mifflin. Pub date is June 8th, 2006. The simplest way, of course, is to go to an online bookseller like Amazon or Barnes & Noble, or hopefully it will be in your local bookstore.
Okay. Well, I thank you for talking with me today.
Thanks very much.